Explore the night skies with our large range of high-quality telescopes. Whether you're a novice or an astronomy expert, we have the right telescope for you in our Australian Geographic e-store. Explore the whole range and find the right telescope for you today. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/shop. That's australiangeographic.com.au/shop. Hello, I'm Chrissy Goldrick, and this is Talking Australia, a podcast by Australian Geographic. Today I'm talking to Ron Allam. Ron is the man who built the sub that got James Cameron to the bottom of the ocean. He's also a pioneering cave diver with many records to his name. Ron will share his unique journey from ABC radio engineer to adventurer, explorer, and inventor. So I'm thrilled to be talking to Ron Allam on this episode of Talking Australia. Well, welcome to the second part of a two-part interview with Ron Allam, one of Australia's, I would say, unsung pioneers of ocean exploration, a man whose ability to turn around any situation just really by his technical know-how and his ability to fix stuff has landed him in some of the greatest adventures of the last 30 to 40 years. In part one, we explored the cave diving history of Ron Allam through his youth and into the mid-1980s when he was involved in the Panakin Plains cave rescue mission. As a result of his cave diving days and his friendship with Andrew White, the filmmaker, Andrew then and Ron sort of set off on another path, really into the world of epic filmmaking. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that today with Ron. So welcome again, Ron. Great to have you back. We finished last time talking about the Panakin Plains cave rescue, which became a successful documentary. And you went from there, then being able to capture film and footage of adventures. It really was in its infancy in those times, and people weren't really turning these kind of adventures into film. But I think sort of the advent of sponsorship of adventure, and also, you know, in the 80s, then television started to transform and there were more places to see things and you could get the video and watch the videotape. And suddenly this sort of whole world kind of expanded and you found a role for yourself with all your technical background and your broadcasting and your training with the ABC. Tell us a little bit about where you went after that Panakin Plains, how the film career started.
Look, after Panakin Plains, Andrew decided that, he'd already produced his first film, but he thought, well, it can't be that hard to earn a living from documentary filmmaking. So he did a story treatment for four films. I think they were all Australia-based, actually, and also to Florida was one of them. Now, I wasn't able to join him on all those expeditions, but it certainly did whet my appetite to travel to North Queensland to do Predators of the North. Or there's another one, Great Whites, probably in South Australia. I didn't get to go to Florida with him. But, yeah, I did start a new career path for me. But I was still working at the ABC, but that came to an end in the early 90s. I had left South Australia. I'd come back to Sydney and I completed work at the ABC Ultimo Studios. But I didn't realise at the time that I had actually worked myself out of a job, and I was then to be made redundant because of the new technology, the central location of all the ABC studios, in one location. So, yeah, I was no longer needed, and that's when I decided to follow Andrew.
And what kind of role did you have with the filmmaking? What was your skill set, and what actually did you do on those shoots?
Yeah, look, when you're on a budget documentary team, you can't just do one role, and I just couldn't just be a cave diver or a diver or someone just being there. So I did have to perform a role. I was, as you mentioned, a sound engineer. So I became sound recordist. You don't need sound recording when you're underwater. So I managed to do a lot of the diving. I also were able to pick up a camera and do a lot of the underwater photography. The other thing that I soon learnt is that when you're on the road with a lot of sensitive film equipment, that you have breakdowns, and I certainly would have used those technical skills to keep cameras operational. So, I kept a lot of things rolling.
You're a troubleshooter.
Being able to, fix and repair gear on the way. And it didn't actually end there. Andrew also wanted me, had his own ideas about, what we needed to do certain, critter cams, putting a camera on a critter, a shark or a
This was would have been very early. I mean, really, we're used to sort of seeing those kind of amazing sort of intimate recordings of wildlife nowadays. But, I mean, it really would have been quite unusual back then. And you were, I guess when you said the predators of the north, you're talking about crocodiles there. You actually went after all the scary things. So you kind of knew what the subject matter was going to be that was really going to capture people's imagination, the scary stuff. So that I guess that comes around to how you ended up swimming with a shark.
Yeah, look, one of Andrew's ambitions was to do a story with great whites. And the first one, we had I think we had the Perspex cage. So he wanted to experience what it'd be like, without anything in front of you except for a sheet of Perspex. But it wasn't very manoeuvrable. It was big, heavy, clunky. On this occasion, he said, can we build a mobile shark cage? We had the Aquazep scooters from the earlier cave expedition. I ended up building a mobile shark cage with two big Aquazep scooters, a fixed buoyancy system so that the diver could control the buoyancy of the cage. Yeah, it was just like an ambition of Andrew's.
Yeah, and then Hollywood came knocking for Andrew, and he ended up going over to America to work, and you came knocking for you eventually. Tell us how you ended up working with James Cameron.
I always say, take opportunities, as they occur. And if one closes, another one's going to open. And what had happened is that Andrew had contracted to work on a large vessel called the Quest. He was advised, several years into this, that the boat, the Quest, was going to be sold, and that Andrew would have to, it would not be available, and the funding would not be available for any future documentaries. So Andrew, with that news, I think we did the one last expedition to Guadeloupe, and that was going to be it. And, he was quite dejected. He went back to his farm. He was standing out in the paddock, and he gets a phone call. And he honestly thought one of his mates was pulling his leg. And the person on the other end, I'm James Cameron. And Andrew did not believe for one moment that it was. And it turned out to be. So all of a sudden, Andrew's into his next phase of his career.
And then how did that, when did you get the call for yourself, and for what reason?
Yeah, Jim had in mind to do another, Jacques Cousteau, Ventures of the Sea. He'd invested in a ship. Andrew quickly told him how much a ship would cost. And I think Andrew was really, like an advisor to James Cameron, from pretty much day one. And Jim sort of went cold turkey on the idea of this adventure series, but Jim's always loved the deep diving, the diving with the Russian mere submersibles, diving the Titanic, and Jim was also in development of his of a 3D camera for Avatar, and he wanted to trial this camera not in a film studio or a swimming pool or a Great Barrier Reef. He wanted to put it back on a Russian Mir submersible and take it back to Titanic. So that's when Andrew called me, is how are we going to get Jim's camera onto a Russian Mir submersible and take it down on Titanic.
So this is after he'd made the Titanic, the movie, for which he had actually filmed, he'd taken these Russian submersibles, deep water, like small subs. He'd already done all of that, so he'd been down to the Titanic and filmed the wreck on the bottom, and then he'd made the movie as well, which also has those sequences in it of the almost like the true life sequences of the crew going down and filming it. So it's after all of that that you got involved.
Yeah, well, Jim had made the film, but I think that was in the mid 90s when it was released, 97 or thereabouts. Mm. But he'd used a 35mm camera with a 6-minute load. And when he built the cameras for Avatar, they were electronic cameras, and he was going to record every moment of a dive on tape inside the Russian Mir sub. So he had to interface the cameras on the outside on a pan and tilt head that could be remotely controlled, to the recording equipment inside. So he did special deals with Sony for the cameras. His brother Mike had built the underwater housing for his rig. It was two cameras side by side. He set the interocular distance. The distance between the two lenses had to be the same as the distance between your eyes. He wanted to converge the cameras, which is one of his patented techniques. He wasn't going to settle with just mediocre testing. He wanted it on a Russian Mir sub. He wanted it to be able to take it to 6,000 metres. He wanted to film and have a Titanic. And
in 3D.
In 3D.
That's what we're talking about, isn't it? That's what this special camera equipment
so,
was.
His movie was 2D film cameras.
Yeah.
Ever since we did that expedition back out to Titanic, he filmed each dive 7 or 8 hours of footage, whereas previously it was 1 6-minute load per dive. So he got this incredible amount of footage. I was then responsible for the second Mir submersible with all of his HMI lights.
This is so he could flood the scene with light
for
the filming of the 3D. And this was going to be the 3D film of the wreck of the Titanic. Yeah, so you'd be basically doing a kind of fly through of the wreck and going up the main staircase and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, so some of the shots from that were just absolutely stunning. And Jim had then decided he had enough footage for, it was planned. It was Ghosts of the Abyss was the 3D, first 3D documentary.
And that was enough for IMAX.
And it was the first 3D film shot on digital cameras that was shown at an IMAX theatre. So it was
groundbreaking stuff.
He proved that the cameras were high quality, 3D, capable of 3D. Most of the 3D at the time at IMAX theatres, you could only watch it for about 20 minutes because you get eye strain or brain strain trying to converge the images. But with Jim's technique of converging cameras. This all became a lot easier to the viewer, and eventually decided that Avatar was a full-length feature, 3D, 100%, and it was because of the developments. Through diving.
So I guess what was your relationship like? Did you get to know him quite well on that expedition? And
I suppose my first encounter was, I think he could have dismissed me pretty much straight away. He's very much a person who is very capable of doing things himself, and he likes things done his way. I'm very much a person that would look at how someone else would do it and do it slightly differently. But achieve equal or better results. So I don't know that he liked me from a word go, but it was at the end of that expedition, another of these end of expedition events, and that was 9/11 happened. And it was quite eerie because we're sort of coming back. We picked up a lot of Americans on the expedition that lived on the East Coast, and they wanted to get home to their families, and the US had grounded all the aircraft. Canada had done the same. I said to Jim, look, the planes are grounded, I'm not going anywhere. We had a couple of malfunctions with some pieces of equipment. We were supposed to follow it up with a dive out to the Bismarck. And I said, look, I'm not going anywhere. There's no planes. I'm here. Would you like me to clean up this equipment? We had some battery, not fires, but battery burnouts on some of the underwater ROVs that his brother had built for him. And, he just looked at me in disbelief. No one really volunteers, unless you're told to do something, you don't do it. So, but I think from that moment, that's when I got a rapport with Jim.
It's quite a leap, really, from that to Challenger Deep, and this very ambitious expedition to the world's deepest point. And your role was obviously very different by the time Jim was planning that one. So, tell us how your role evolved to be the person that ended up designing the submersible that would actually take him to the world's deepest point.
2005, we did a program called Titanic Live, and Jim had been asked to do a live telecast from Titanic, and I needed a broadcast system, and I was the one that was called in to design the broadcast system. We had to put a fiber optic cable on the Mir submersible. We had to have a rigid hull inflatable boat built with a special fibre winch and a radio system to link it to the main mothership for this telecast to happen. And it was really because of the success of that I had built and designed the broadcast system for what we call TLO5, that's when we really started talking about, what do we do next? How can we build a vehicle to go to the bottom, the deepest spots on, the world's oceans? How do we bring back the images? How do we go about it? And, so Jim started looking at companies in the US and had asked people to quote, put up proposals, design things, and no one listened to what Jim wanted. And, we eventually got talking and, he said, well, we could, if you could look at the feasibility of doing this. So I set about, setting up our own high-pressure test vessel at home in Australia. I started testing components and thinking of different ways of creating underwater lights that weren't in pressure vessels, motors that didn't need the electronics in pressure vessels, to make it all lighter. And I end up spending 1 or 2 years saying to Jim that, yes, we can do this. And that's when he said, well, can you build a sphere? I said, well, I've never built a sphere, but we'll give it a go. So literally that's, I guess how it all started. And that was at the end of 2005 that, started looking into diving to full ocean depth. I suppose early scientists, I even saw a paper very recently saying that full ocean depth is 6,000 metres. Because scientists believed that, nothing would survive, or once believed that nothing would survive below 6,000 metres, and it's only a small percentage of the world's oceans. The size of North America or the size of Australia, but it didn't really matter because nothing lived down there. Why go there? Why bother? And even today, some of the top universities only have test equipment that will go down to 6,000 metres. Mm. We had to sort of break that myth. We had to look for equipment that was full ocean depth rated. If it wasn't available, then we would have to create it and make it.
We'll take a quick break and be back in a moment. We have a special offer for all our listeners. Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's 3 issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Plus, you'll receive exclusive benefits, including 10% off all our products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. And where did you do? I interviewed you for a story a few years ago. I think you developed some of this in your own backyard, didn't you, in Sydney?
Yeah, a lot of it. Our first pressure vessel was in our laundry. Mm. I would quietly pump it up over night time with a hydraulic jack. We're talking 20,000 pounds per square inch, which is, 4 times the normal hydraulic jack pressures. I would religiously pump it up most nights, change out the, what I was testing during the day. And, just quietly went around, that business of qualifying electronic components, finding battery cells that would operate at full ocean depth pressures.
And you worked hard to keep the project in Australia and to keep the components in Australia. Tell us about that.
The project was destined to be done in the US. That was Jim's ambition. I suppose the first thing that happened is that Jim wanted a titanium sphere. If you look at the world price at titanium, it peaked when I was searching titanium. Nowadays, it's a quarter of a price. But then it was the most expensive and a very long lead time to obtain it. So I had to tell Jim that the price of titanium, it would cost $2.5 million for the material. It would be a 2.5 year lead time by the time you place an order. Then we would have to forge it, weld it, machine it, etc., etc. And that would have spelt the end of the project because he wasn't going to fund that sort of money on the sphere. But in the meantime, I had researched an Australian metallurgist out of Victoria. I hopped on a plane and met him the next day in Melbourne. And first words were, why titanium? He took me to a forge in Melbourne, some machine shops. And basically we concluded that we can get the steel out of Newcastle. We can forge it in Albury. We can machine it in Melbourne. We welded it in Adelaide. And we had to send it to the United States to have it pressure tested. And he ended up with a sphere for less than $1 million.
Wow.
And we started work almost immediately, yeah.
So the sphere, a little bit like the sphere in the Mir submersibles, is where the pilot sits. But that's just a small component, really, of what was actually going to take Jim down to Challenger Deep. Tell us about how you developed the rest of the submersible and why it was such a game changer.
Yeah, okay, the sphere was end up being steel. It was still, we used some metals in that that were stronger for weight than titanium. So, you know, titanium being, you know, fantastic material is not necessarily so. It does have, it is better as far as corrosion. But look, there were other aspects of it. One, the other thing was that the sphere was still going to be 2.5 tons negatively buoyant. We had to float it. It weighed 2.5 tons. It displaced only about a ton of water. So it was still 1.5 tons negatively buoyant. We had to float it, and we needed flotation material. The only problem there was that Jim wanted to use the flotation material structurally. And, you know, so I had asked or requested samples from various manufacturers. When I tested them, we found that these foams could not be used structurally because if you subject them to hydrostatic pressure, they would bend, crack or buckle. So I thought, well, again, it's one of these stories that if you tell Jim, well, you can't use it structurally, and that was his idea, you know, I was trying to figure what could be an alternative. And that's when, yeah, I decided that... Well, if you look at manufacturing foam differently to convention, then maybe we can come up with a new type of material. And, yeah, that's what we did.
And you basically invented that new material, is that right? You patented it.
Yeah. I remember telling Jim that conventional foams out of the US would distort, break and crack under pressure. The chances are you'll lose a part of your flotation, you're not coming up. So he wouldn't have liked that. So, and, you know, on the next same breath, you know, you'd have to then go into a spiel that, look, I've got an idea. I think we can make it. And I'd already made a little piece that was uniform and that we had tested and that we knew it could do the job. And, his next question was, well, is it new? And I said, yes, or I think so. Then he said, patent it, which we did. So
great. And then the sub itself is it doesn't resemble the when we think of a submarine shape, something that goes through the water in a sort of vertical way. Tell us about the sort of horizontal way in which the sub sort of moves up and down the water column, and why you came up with that innovation.
Yeah. Jim really led the design. His concept, basic physics, what he wanted to do was to, minimise the transit time. He wanted to get down there quick, get up quick, so he could spend the maximum time on the seafloor, because that's where the research is, the science. That's where he wanted to be. You build a skyrocket, something that's, tall and vertical, so that, it's more streamlined in ascent and descent.
So it's sort of like a fat, squat, cigar-shaped type of...
Yeah, but it's stood
like
vertically.
A column. Yeah.
Whereas a lot of other submersibles are more, horizontally
That's right.
shaped.
Yeah.
And, they're designed that they have a propeller at the end and they can cruise around and look for things on the seafloor. But when you're spending most of your time in ascent or descent, it comes a point where you may as well have a rocket-shaped ship rather than a something that is horizontal. A vertical machine is going to go through that water column a lot quicker. And, we did actually make it a little bit streamlined in the forward direction because Jim also wanted it to traverse around on the seafloor at the bottom of the trenches.
So it still needed to move around.
So it still had to move
in a vertical plane.
So, yeah, we found that the shape was quite, conducive, that it could actually fly around, standing vertically without too much of a problem.
And you tested it, and then the day came when you were hovering, I suppose, or floating over the Marianas Trench. So tell us a bit about Challenger Deep, how you get there, and then what happened when you got there, and how the whole expedition played out, because it was such a big expedition. It was one of the last really great expeditions where somebody's achieved a real sort of first. I mean, Jim wasn't the first person to go down to Challenger Deep, of course, because there had been an expedition there in the early 1960s, but he was the first person to stay down there and collect that sort of data.
Yeah. The sub was first tested in Garden Island in Sydney on Australia Day 212.
Ah.
Okay, so it's sort of got, it was built in Australia. So I think that, it was quite important. The second dive was Jervis Bay, slightly deeper. Mm. But then we went up to New Guinea, and I think that's where the big dive started. We had a 2,000-metre ROV on the ship, so the first dives were below 2,000 metres so that we had support.
Could they go down to 2,000 and then the vessel would go on its own for the next? Stay with them?
No, the vessel was totally, Deep Sea Challenge would dive alone, but it wasn't, those first few dives were limited to 2,000 metres.
Right.
So we'd pick an area of seafloor where you couldn't go deeper, so that if it got into trouble, it wouldn't come up, something failed. Then we had ROVs on board the ship that could help. And Jim felt that quite important. But then we quickly moved, to 4,000 metres, I think, and then it was 8,000 metres. as soon as we did the successful dive at 8, then we went up to Guam, where we re-equipped the boat with supplies. And then we moved down to a small island group. I think it's the North Carolina group. And we really set up base camp, if you like, on board the ship, in relatively calm waters where we could, do that last-minute preparations on Deep Sea Challenger in the shelter of a coral island lagoon. And then with weather breaks, we'd steam 24 hours up to the Marianas Trench, halfway between this island group and Guam. So, having a nice calm area to work from is quite important.
Mm. And when you were, how long were you there over the top of the trench before the actual real attempt happened? I mean, did you get to go down there
Jim, we did the two dives, an unmanned dive and then Jim's dive to the Marianas Trench to 11,000 metres. Then I think it was actually 10,900 metres.
Mm.
A little bit of controversy as to where the deepest spot is, but nevertheless it's, to the bottom of the Marianas Trench. But I end up doing a dive in this island group to 1,100 metres. And, piloting something that you've worked on for several years. And, it was quite amazing. It was sort of one of the last dives of the expedition. We had a lot of the systems all functional and working. So I had one of the best dives of the entire expedition, albeit it wasn't 11,000 metres.
But tell me about it. So were you actually testing it, and you were testing out all the different systems? Or did you actually take a bit of time just to look out the window and enjoy what you could see outside?
Yeah, the reason why I really got to pilot is that when Jim does a project, you've got to get all the shots. And what he wanted you know, we had cameras on the sub, it could film itself. We had cameras inside, outside. Yeah, we had cameras everywhere on its thing, which we had to design, of course, and have built. He wanted a few wider shots of a sub on the seafloor to put into the film, go through the motions of using the manipulator just to tell an audience that, you know, this is how the manipulator would work.
Is this like the manipulator arm on the outside?
Yeah.
The one that had all the Rolex watches on its wrist.
Had a very expensive Rolex on it. But, yeah, you have to have those shots to tell the story, tell what the sub's capability was. And it didn't really matter that it wasn't at the bottom of a Marianas Trench. But, you know, it had to show that, you know, it's capable of science, it was intent with science. And I think Jim was curious about the ROVs on board the ship. So he said, well, you're not diving deeper than 2,000 metres because I want to film you on the bottom with the ROVs. So Jim ended up in the control shack on the ship driving these ROVs and still directing the show to me while I was diving 1,100 metres in the Deep Sea Challenger. But it was absolutely fantastic. Where I dived, there was a bit of a current. He wanted me to land next to the lander, which had been positioned, pre-positioned there beforehand. He was directed us there. He told us exactly where to put the ship, and which I was able to do precisely. Then we went for a bit of a tour. We had no idea of the area, but we came across this, you know, 1,100 metres and this coral.
So far down.
Absolutely amazing landscape. And, it was one of the best dives of the entire expedition as far as, seeing something, working with the lander, which is a stationary vehicle that was just pre-positioned on the seafloor. Jim was able to get the shots with the ROV. So he had the sub, the lander, the ROV, all at the same time. So, that was very exciting to be part of that.
Sounds good. And then when the actual final, the real dive right to the bottom came, how long did it take to get to the bottom once it was in the water?
I think Jim was, when he said, release, it was indicating to the divers to let the flotation off, to keep it on the surface. He accelerated to about 6 knots and he's on the bottom within 90 minutes.
90 minutes.
Yeah, and he describes it like being in an express elevator to the bottom of the ocean.
So a little bit like a rocket, a space rocket in reverse, going down really fast. Yeah. So he had maximum time down there on the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, he had... on his dive, he did have a couple of malfunctions with the manipulator, teething systems with, various parts, various components. It was inevitable because it was such a short build time. These are things that we worked on board the ship and we resolved a lot of them. As I said, my dive was very successful. Because it was one of the last dives.
Yeah. And so that was then. And these days you are, I suppose, really a leading light in submersible technology research. Tell us about all of the learnings that you took from all of that and what you're working on these days, Ron.
I suppose it was an ambition of mine that I'd put so much time and effort into Deep Sea Challenger. That, many, many, many unpaid hours that, I don't know, I think to throw it away at the end of the expedition would have been a tremendous waste. So, I was able to negotiate with James Cameron that, I could take on the equipment here in Australia and set up some sort of deep sea submergence facility. And that was based on the fact that Australia has some of the deepest water around our continent but has not been visited. And we thought there might be some sort of
opportunity.
Yeah. And Unfortunately, it's been a very hard, difficult road. We've set up the equipment. We've now got our own premises down in Tarrant Point in Sydney. And we are slowly making inroads. We have revised a lot of the equipment that we used. Our batteries have been fully revised. Our motors are fully revised. And we now test each of our designs to at least 20 cycles to full ocean depth, 200 hours endurance. So when we go back, and we are going back with various vehicles, that they're going to be a lot more robust and reliable.
Who wants to go to the bottom of the ocean? Who's queuing up to get down there? What kind of people?
Look, there's I can say that probably the world's deepest diving submersible at the moment is owned by the Chinese. It's Jialong, it's 7,500 metres, so there's certainly interest in other foreign countries. Going deep, there's mineral resources. We don't want to see plummeting of the ocean floors or anything, but there's some I think there's a lot of exploration still to be done, and I think it's really giving anyone the opportunity to do that exploration and research.
There's sort of almost two schools of thought, really, with ocean exploration. I suppose the same with space is the manned versus the unmanned. What is it that makes us really, I know that there's been a lot of innovation in unmanned exploration wherever, but we still want to be there ourselves, don't we? Do you think some humans are just sort of driven to want to see these things with their own eyes? So, I mean, the technology that you're working on now, is that like, is it remote controlled, or is it also technology to take human beings down to the deepest depths of the ocean?
There is certainly an element to humans being inquisitive and wanting to be there. On the other hand, a real world with occupational health and safety, a lot of people involved in the oceans don't want divers in the water because it is unsafe, dangerous. Not that I necessarily think so, but there is this move more into autonomy for scientist workers, particularly oil and gas, where depths are getting deeper and deeper and deeper. So, I still think there is room for the human element, and I'll certainly be involved in another vehicle if the opportunity arose. So.
Well, look, I'm sure there will be more opportunities for you with your amazing talent for invention and innovation and troubleshooting. And it's led you to a very adventurous life, but one in which you yourself have sort of moved forward the boundaries almost of physics and allowed all of us, really, who had a look at James Cameron's films to actually experience it, even rather vicariously, to actually experience this whole realm, this whole unexplored area of the Earth that that has so much potential. So thank you very much, Ron Allam. It's just been lovely to speak to you, and thank you once again for sharing your amazing life story with us. That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia with Ron Allam. If you have questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com. Or find us on Instagram, @Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find special offers for our listeners, including 10% off all products purchased in our e-store. So don't wait and go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so you never miss an episode. Thanks for listening. Until next time.